hope you guys enjoy the weather today. Okay, lecture number 2 in philosophy. We'll be dealing with chapters 3 and hopefully 4 in Geisner and Feinberg's book, Introduction to Philosophy of Christian Perspective. Chapter 3 deals with methodology in philosophy. Methodology in philosophy, different methods. Now, since philosophy is a law of wisdom of pursuing of the truth, and all we're talking about is different methods to pursue the truth. And they go over different methods of finding truth. First they start with some methods from the ancient world, such as Socrates' method, or Socrates, Socrates' method, which is interrogation. Zeno's method, which is called reductio ad absurdum. That's Latin for reducing your opponent's position to the absurd. And then Aristotle's method, which is deduction. So these are three ancient views, ancient methods of finding truth. So let's take a look at those three. Socrates lived from about 469 BC to 399 BC. And interrogation, his method was the question and answer method. He believed that men knew all the answers that they were ever going to need in a previous existence. And that question will bring the answers out. Hey, now we think that sounds pretty stupid. Number one, though, there's a lot of Greek mythology and views of the gods and stuff like that this guy was brought up with, and views about reincarnation that he was brought up with. But also, the fact is, you can talk to an idiot and get some pretty complex answers from them. So you can talk to an idiot, and if you just question him enough, he'll start giving you information that it's unbelievable that the guy had access to that information.
Of course, Joe.
Yeah. But the thing is, I think a lot of it is due to the fact that God creates us with innate ideas in the subconscious, if you will, and then certain things, certain experiences in the sense realm or whatever trigger these ideas out, these concepts out. We don't learn about equality from looking at two equal size cups. We determine that they're equal because we go into that experience, that sense experience with the concept of equality already in our subconscious. But whatever the case, interrogation, because they have prior lives, you start bringing it out. L. Ron Hubbard, his view of the Thetans, that we were gods from other planets and we just didn't know it and we were evolving, now we're evolving to the point where we're recognizing that we're gods. That's a lot like it too. Looking inside for the answers. Zeno's method, reductio ad absurdum.
Yeah. So, if that's the case, though, when he dies, when he comes back again, you have to ask all these interesting questions all over again, so you're going to forget what happened in this life?
Yeah, but again, with reincarnation, though, you're heading towards, you're hopefully moving up a scale, not back. And, Zeno's method, reductio ad absurdum, he lived around 475 BC, somewhere during that time. His view was to reduce, to find truth, was to reduce alternative positions to their absurd conclusions. To reduce alternative positions to their absurd conclusions. Problem with that view was that you can expose falsehood but it doesn't always prove something true. Gordon Clark uses that more than anything else. He uses the law of non-contradiction and reduces all other non-Christian views, all non-Christian views, reduces them to their absurdity, to their contradictions. But the fact is, after Gordon Clark's chopped out every tree in the forest, the only tree that stands is the tree of Christianity. Somebody else can plant another tree. And he doesn't know. Maybe he died already, but maybe 10 years after he dies, somebody's going to plant a new tree, come up with a new worldview. So you're never going to be able to refute every view. And even if you did, a new one might pop up. But even that, it doesn't show that something is true. It shows that all these other alternatives that you looked at have been reduced to an absurd position. Now, what Zeno would try to do is try to find an either-or situation. Either this is true or that is true, and then reduce the option, the only alternative left for us, to an absurd position. Now, Zeno, he was one of the greatest debaters in the history of mankind, but he, and by the way, Gordon Clark has pointed out, no one in physics has ever really given a good explanation for motion. No one has really proven that motion really occurs. And so we'll get into the arguments against certainty or whatever, but Zeno argued that for me to move from this chair, from chair A to chair B, first, I would have to go halfway. Then to get from this halfway point to chair B, I would have to go halfway. Then to get from this point to the chair, I'd have to go halfway. You go on and on, you never reach the other chair. What he was showing was that it appears to be impossible to move from point A to point B. In other words, movement is impossible, movement is an illusion, therefore his conclusion was, we are all one being. He ends up with a pantheistic, everything, a monistic view. Everything is one being. Sounds ridiculous, but when it comes to refuting it, it's very, very tough. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but Aquinas' response would be that there's an infinite, there's a potentially infinite amount of points between point A and B. That's in the potential realm, the possible realm. But in the actual realm, you can only have a set of finite points, a limited number of points between point A and point B. In other words, yeah, you can go half and half and half on and on forever, but if you took something that actually exists, like this marker, and you laid them down side by side, there'd only be a finite number between this chair and that chair. Even if you went with straight things, there'd only be a finite number between this chair and that chair.
What if the point you picked was twice the distance from that chair to that chair, when you get to the halfway point, you'd be at that chair?
What do you mean?
You said you have to travel half that distance, and then from that point to there, half that distance. Mm-hmm. What if the point you picked, say this was distance X, was 2 times X?
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get to X and you covered half the distance, you'd actually be at that chair.
You mean, but if you're saying from Zeno, take Zeno's paradox and just make a halfway point, and you'd already be at the halfway point. Yeah, but he would still argue that even to do that before you can still get to the halfway point, you have to reach another halfway point, another one. But he's only dealing with potentialities. What Aquinas would say is he confused potentialities with actualities, things that actually exist, and there's a difference. It's like the logical realm deals with potentialities or possibilities. Whereas actualities, the guys that would argue that it is not logically, my existence is not logically necessary. It's logically possible that I don't exist. However, he would argue that it is actually undeniable that I exist. Because even in order to deny my existence, I must first actually exist to make a denial. Because nothing is nothing, nothing does nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. Therefore, just to make a denial, means that I must actually exist to make the denial. So actual undeniability, which would be arguing like the Thomist and arguing like Aquinas argued, actual undeniability is a very strong principle to work from. At the same time, it's not logical necessity. Logical necessity deals with the possible realm. Logical necessity, like, it puts you in the realm of those things that are true by definition. They tell you nothing about reality. There could be an infinite number of possible worlds, but there's only one actual world. See, I don't want to get too far ahead on that, but anyway, Aristotle's method, deduction. Aristotle's method. Aristotle lived from about 384 BC to 322 BC. Deduction, this is something you have to know. In fact, this is real important stuff. These guys are going to show up on the test, but deduction argues from the general to the particular. The general to the particular. Later on, we're going to talk about induction, which argues from the particular to the general. You must know these inside out. I've seen guys who have doctorate degrees in theology that make write a real scholarly paper, and the whole mistake is they are arguing from induction, thinking that they had the power of deduction there, the strength of deduction, and then they blow themselves out of the water. The way I remember deduction arguing from the general to the particular is, it's real dumb, this is just the way I remember it. I would always say, the general, like slang. Okay? And then, in part, for induction from particular to general, deduction from the general to particular, okay? For instance, induction would say, I looked at one man and he died. I looked at the life of another man and he died. I looked at another man and he died. Therefore, I conclude that all men will die. See, it's induction, arguing from the particular to the general. Deduction, you would start out with the general premise, all men are mortal, therefore this particular guy over here, Harry, is going to die someday. No, they're induction is not really a modern method, though they put it down as it. People used to use induction. In fact, to be honest with you, Plato used deduction more than Aristotle, because he believed in the universal's ideas. Aristotle actually used induction more than Plato. But for the most part, it was not considered as big of an emphasis until the modern scientific method. Modern science argues from particulars. You know, we find 1,000 ping pong balls and they're all white, so we assume that all the ping pong balls that exist are white. Gordon Clark would say there's no real way of knowing that. David Hume said that too. You can suggest it, but even when you bring in probability, there's no way to be certain that all the ping pong balls are going to be white. But anyway, but keep that in mind, the difference between the two. But Aristotle actually, like Aquinas argues like Aristotle, he started from the particulars. Particular things in nature are dependent on something else to keep them in existence. Eventually, you argue to the existence of an independent being as the cause of all other existence. That was induction, whereas Plato would argue more from the general, the world of the universals.
Yeah. I got a question. Could you transfer words, like, say in general, say like apparent and the particular actual?
No, I think the best thing you could do is you say like, instead of general, put universal and maybe specific.
Okay.
So arguing from the universal First, I'll give you an example. There was a guy I read a paper, he's not real trained in heavy philosophy, but he wrote a paper arguing that whenever you're baptized with the Holy Spirit, it'll be evidenced by speaking in tongues. Okay? He argued he took the cases in the book of Acts. And let's say there were 7 cases of guys being baptized with the Holy Spirit in the book of Acts. 5 of them said that the guy spoke in tongues. The other 2 didn't say they spoke in tongues, but it didn't say they didn't. So he argued from that therefore, since the only 5 cases that talk about baptism with the Holy Spirit, but also talk about speaking in tongues, since 5 out of 5 of those cases, they spoke in tongues, therefore, the conclusion should be that all Christians that get baptized with the Holy Spirit speak in tongues. It's a problem with that. It's an induction argument. He looked at 7 cases, only 5 of them really applied, because the other 2 didn't mention the tongues, whether or not they were spoken. But he looked at 5 cases. How many cases are there? Are there really 7? No. There are, 10 million? 100 million? How many Christians are there that have been baptized with the Holy Spirit? Millions of them. So, to take 5 and say, I've got a real strong, airtight argument, no, it's not an airtight argument. He used an induction. An induction is only strong based on the probability, the percentage of the whole. If you had 1,000 ping pong balls and you found 999 of them and they were all white, there's a pretty high probability that last one is white. However, if you had 1,000 ping pong balls and you found 5 of them and they were all white, you really don't have a whole lot to go on about those other 995. Now, what he should have done, he could have went with a stronger. The way I would argue would be a deductive argument. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, all of you Corinthians are baptized in the Spirit. You've all been baptized into Christ by the Holy Spirit. But then he says, not all of you speak in tongues. That's a deductive statement because you're arguing from the general to the specific. The thing is, a deductive argument, if the premises are true, and it's a valid argument and they flow properly, the conclusion must be true. Inductive, even if the particulars are true, the premises are true, you still only have a high, best you can do is a high degree of probability. Unless you examine the whole set, and then it becomes a deductive argument.
You said so.
So, what the key is there, what the Pentecostals will do in that case, at least the school of thought of the Pentecostals that he's from, they will say, well, that's just being baptized in the Spirit, which is different from baptism with the Holy Spirit. But there's no biblical justification for that whatsoever. And baptism of the Holy Spirit, baptism with the Holy Spirit, the same word in the Greek for of or with. We just interpret it differently.
But you were talking about science using mostly induction.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it seem weird that they use induction to be able to back up and support deductive arguments?
Until
they find a case where it's not applicable, then they have to modify the scientific
form. There really isn't any. I don't think there's...
Well, no, when they talk about scientific quantum theory, they have a general premise that they expect everything else to follow, uniformitarian, or...
They start with an induction...
And then they create...
And argue...
A universal premise.
Yeah, not really create, but through induction, they argue, the law of thermodynamics, and then from that law, they interpret everything else by it. They can begin to deduce things. But for all practical purposes, that's all finite ideas can do. Since we're not all knowing, that's all we can do. The thing is, though, what the scientists need to realize is that just the fact that it started with induction means that they do not have all the answers. Now, I read a book by a guy named Hildebrand. a Catholic philosopher, made a real interesting point. He said that the two basic tenets, the two basic premises that modern man is working with, and by what he calls modern man, most Christian philosophers would really call postmodern man, because modern man was real rationalistic, like Descartes, he thought they could find all the answers with certainty. Postmodern man realizes he can't, even Schaeffer calls postmodern man modern man, but he's really postmodern man. Beyond modern man, he realizes he doesn't have any answers. And so he gets all the press, but postmodern man, here's the dilemma that he lives with. He says, there's only two things that I know. One, there is no absolute truth.
But that's an absolute truth.
So again, even beyond this, even beyond the fact, yep, that's
a universal negative.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is the two things that the modern postmodern man lives with. Number one, there is no absolute truth. Now, Kurt, you pointed out, I don't want to get too far ahead, but the statement, there is no absolute truth, if that is true, that is an absolute truth. So if it's true, it's false. It's a self-refuting statement, so therefore it has to be false. But they believe there is no absolute truth, and then number two, they believe that atheistic evolution is absolutely true. Okay? You debate it. You can go ahead and debate a non-Christian philosopher, an atheist philosopher, and every time you start arguing for God, it says, sounds real good, but we can't know anything with certainty. I think all truth is relative. It's true for you, it's true for you, it's not going to be true for me, vice versa. We'll never really know. There's no way of knowing. He's a skeptic about almost every area of life. But then all of a sudden, when you say you don't believe in evolution, he says, what are you, an idiot? Don't you know evolution's been proven beyond all reasonable doubt? So, here they start off, you know, we can't know anything. However, we do know that evolution is true. That's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people. Postmodern man doesn't even think anymore. Doesn't think rationally. We know more of what we're getting into. One of my theology professors defined philosophy as knowing more and more about less and less, and so finally you reach the point where you know everything there is to know about nothing. But I don't think that's true about Christian philosophy. But when you look at secular man, if you reject, if human reason leads you into the throne room of God, if you reject the true God, then you're damned. It's like Paul said about false teachers in 2 Timothy 3:7, always learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. So they learn more and more lies, but they never learn, so they continue to learn, but they just keep learning more and more mistakes. They never do find the truth.
It's like there will come a time when they will reject some doctrine.
Yeah. So they put Aristotle down for deduction, even though, to be honest with you, Aristotle also made famous induction as well. Those were the three ancient views. The deduction argues from the general to the particular. It argues like this. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. If the premises are true, then you have the two premises there, and then the conclusion. Okay? All the premises is a statement that forms part of your argument. Okay? In a deductive argument, if the premises are true, and if the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises, then the conclusion must be true. The problem is, how do you prove that all men are mortal? Just because 100 billion men who've lived in the history of mankind have died doesn't mean that somebody else is going to live without dying. Okay? So, the deduction is great, it gives you definite truth. The problem is, this is where Gordon Clark comes in. There's no way to prove your universal premises. They've got to be assumed or presupposed. However, I would say this though, you can still find evidence for your presuppositions. Some things are just so obvious that to deny them is absurd. To deny that you exist, or to deny the law of non-contradiction, or to deny the law of causality, And so I would agree with Aquinas on his first principles of knowledge. Anyway, that series of premises that we talked about, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. The series of propositions is called the deductive syllogism. You know, all that means is just a deductive argument. The strength in it, as we mentioned, is that a valid deductive syllogism brings a certain conclusion. Whereas with induction, it's only probable. Okay? It's, induction would be sun rose yesterday, sun rose today, and you try to conclude sun will rise every day. That's induction. The sun will probably rise every day. Okay? And of course, we're not talking about whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun. We're not getting into science right now. We're just talking philosophy, so we're using what is called phenomenological language. But I don't want to get into that right now. But the doctrine would say, we start out, the sun will rise every day. But the sun will rise every morning, and then the sun will rise every morning. The morning is about to come, therefore the sun will rise. The morning will come in 5 minutes, therefore the sun will rise in 5 minutes. You know, something along those lines, and I could have worded it a lot better than that. But you see, with deduction, if the premises are true, the conclusion is guaranteed, but and it has to be, by the way, validity, we're going to get into this a little later. Validity and truth mean the same exact thing for the guy on the street, but they do not equal the same thing for the philosopher. You can have a valid argument with false conclusion, and you can have an invalid argument with a true conclusion. For instance, I could say, bachelors are rugged individuals. All bachelors are rugged individuals. Doug is a rugged individual, therefore Doug is a bachelor. Well, the conclusion is true. Doug is a bachelor. But the definition of bachelor is wrong. So one of the premises is out to lunch. At the same time, though, too, you know, and now we weren't even using, we're using inductive, but you can even have arguments with true conclusion that are valid. We'll get to that when we get to it. But validity, all validity deals with is the structure of the argument. If A, then B. B, conclusion, then A. Okay? That's valid. But you can have a false conclusion. Now, if everything were invalid, you still come up with a false conclusion. We'll get to that a little later. But in a deductive argument, if the premises are true and it's in a valid form, then the conclusion must be true. So that's the strength of it, certain conclusion. The weakness, though, is that universal or general propositions are rarely agreed upon. It's very rarely agreed that, okay, murder is, or killing is always wrong. Right away, what kind of argument are we doing? That's the first premise. Killing is always wrong. Deduction, yep. Let's see, killing is always wrong. Yeah. We killed Manson And then conclusion, it was wrong to kill. It was wrong to kill Manson. The problem with that is this universal. If you're against capital punishment, you would say, yeah, that's valid and all, but you would agree with this. I, myself, and everybody in this room would disagree with killing is always wrong. Some people, it is right to kill them, such as somebody who's trying to kill you or a convicted cold-blooded murderer. Now, then you can even get beyond that. Even if everything was true there in premise one, even if everybody accepted that, premise two is false. Because we didn't kill Charles Manson. We're paying for his food. He's still in the... still alive today. That Kurt's waiting for his next album. Okay. So, since the weakness is universal, a general proposition to really agree upon, most philosophers agree that even with deduction, we've got to settle for highly probable conclusions, which means we look for a universal principle that is highly probable, like second law of thermodynamics, the universe is winding down, and things like that. If you find universally agree, people that almost everybody in the world would agree with your first premise, the universal premise, then it's easier to you can settle for a highly probable conclusion. Some methods in the modern world. Induction. Remember, Aristotle did induction, so in Aquinas, you followed in Aristotle's footsteps. But induction argues from the parts, the particulars, to the general conclusion or the universal conclusion. Francis Bacon, scientist who lived from 1561 to 1626, he stressed it as a scientific tool, and Bacon joined this method with scientific experimentation. He took the method and he experimented with things. The conclusions are not certain unless all parts are considered. Therefore, the more parts, the more probable the conclusion. For instance, let's say there's four cars in my driveway. If we argue from induction that car one is red, we know that from experiment, looking at it, finding out it's red, and that car two is red, and that car three is red, and car four is red, then we can conclude through induction that all four cars are red. And we would have a foul-proof argument there because we've looked at every part in this general set. Okay? If we only looked at three of the four cars, though, we can conclude that the fourth car is probably red, but that would be very weak in the induction. There's no real, unless I just like red cars, there's no real way that we could know. But the more you look at usually, the more it's going to determine. If you looked at 1,000 days and the sun rose on all 1,000 of those days, then it's reasonable. You have a high degree of probability the sun is going to rise tomorrow. However, if you only looked at one day and saw the sun rise, you don't have a highly probable argument that it's going to rise tomorrow if you have no other data there whatsoever. So keep in mind, induction argues for the parts and the general. That's like, I could say all the people in this room are young. Doug is in this room, therefore Doug is young. That's a deductive argument. But I could also argue the same way through induction by saying Phil is young, Kurt is young, Jeff is young, Pam is young, Rory is young, Doug is young, therefore all the people in this room are young. Okay? But the problem is we can't see all the people in this room, or we don't know all the people in this room, or somebody's hiding behind a door, something along those lines, then we're using induction without every member of the set. So you see where we're getting at from there? So the more parts, the higher percentage of the whole, the more probable the conclusion becomes. You know, when we argue that the universe, elements of the universe need something, need a cause for their existence, we haven't examined everything in the universe. We're arguing inductively. But the more things we examine in the universe, the stronger, the more probable our conclusion comes. The scientific method. The scientific method is really just a usage of the inductive method with certain guidelines. And by the way, not everything in science uses the scientific method. Evolution and creation can't even get started with it. They're just ways to interpret the evidence. But the scientific method has to start with observation. You can't do that. Now, it doesn't provide absolutely certain results, which really makes you wonder why scientists are so dogmatic about what they believe. It starts with observation. You observe a process. Then you propose a question or a problem. Then you come up with a hypothesis, which is an educated guess or solution to the problem. Then you experiment to see if that educated guess comes out. And when it works over a period of time, then you come up with a theory. And all a theory is a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. An educated guess that seems to work over and over again. And then a theory that's shown to be valid for, as far as we know, on a universal scale, we come up with what is called the natural law. Okay. For instance, we observe that if you burn a log, once you burn the log completely to give us heat, we can no longer reuse that log for heat any longer. We've used all the energy. It's no longer usable to us. So we see that the amount of usable energy is winding down there. Let's take something real, a lot more common. Let's say the six of us went out to eat and we all got stomach poison. And we looked at the things that we ate, we found out we all had mushrooms through observation. So we observed we all got stomach poison. Then we proposed a question. How did we get the stomach poison? We come up with our hypothesis. They all had mushrooms. Maybe it was the mushrooms. We experiment. We decided to give Rory some of those same mushrooms for the next week. He still improves. He doesn't get worse. So our theory is it's not the mushrooms. Okay? We propose another hypothesis to find out that we also all had salami. So then we give Kurt the salami, we experiment with Kurt the salami for the rest of the week, and he dies. We come up with a theory it was caused by the salami. Then it gets so widely recognized that we come up with this. Well, we're calling it a natural law here. It wouldn't actually be a natural law, but we're coming up with this thing that salami is not edible. Salami is poisonous. It kills everybody, okay?
We could also theorize that salami kills people named Kurt.
They
have to get a bunch of Kurts together and feed them all salami.
Well, what do you do then? Then you start them in doves.
That he called me a
science. And it's all done to further the cause of science. So the scientific method. Now, some contemporary methods some contemporary methods that are really out to lunch. The existential method. These guys are really giving up on finding truth through reason. Søren Kierkegaard, who from 1813 to 1855 was the father of modern existentialism, he taught that subjective truth, inward truth, inward beliefs, subjective beliefs are more important than objective truth. Truth is personal. It's what you believe, not propositional like statements. Such as the car is red. All that matters is you believe the car is red. Truth is found in experience, in living, not in the rational realm. So he recommended we take a leap of faith into the non-rational realm, and by our will we find truth rather than by our reason. Jean-Paul Sartre took this a little further and said that values are created, not discovered. He said, man goes thrust into life without meaning. There's no meaning to life, so we need to subjectively create meaning for our life. So the existential method, forget the reason, you just take a leap of blind faith. The phenomenological method, we're getting way behind, so I'm just going to rush through this. Phenomenological method of Edmund Husserl, from 1859-1938, he attempts to avoid all presuppositions, just let the facts speak for themselves. However, it's very naive to presuppose that this view alone, this method alone, has no presuppositions. In other words, he makes a presupposition and presupposes that this view alone has no presuppositions. The verification method, we talked about that by A.J. Ayer, lived from 1910 to 1970. A.J. Ayer said that for a statement to be true, it must be purely definitional, or else it must be verifiable by one or more of the five senses. The problem is, the verification principle is not either. So, if it is true, it fails its own test. The falsification principle, Anthony Flew argued that any statement is meaningless unless it is subject to falsification. He gave his parable of the invisible gardener. Two guys, one guy thinks that they walk in the wilderness to see a garden. One says, therefore a gardener exists. The other one says, no, it just got here by chance. So they look, they can't see the gardener. They wait for him. They have bloodhounds. They can't smell the gardener. They get electrifiable fences. There's no way to detect the gardener. So the non-believer says, therefore no gardener exists. The believer says, no, he exists. He just can't be detected. And so Anthony Flew says, well, what is the difference between your God and no God at all? Since you can't find him through the senses or whatever. The fact is, though, you could have falsified the God of the Bible if you would have produced the rotting corpse of Jesus Christ. You could have falsified it if you could have done that, but you couldn't do it because Jesus did rise from the dead. God proved the invisible gardener has made himself visible through Jesus Christ and becoming a man. His rising from the dead verified who he is, and also the predictions that God made in the Bible have all come to pass, at least the ones that are supposed to be fulfilled up to this point, have all come to pass. If God predicts something that doesn't come to pass, then you can falsify the God of the Bible. Our God is not a silent God. Then there's also the clarification method of Ludwig Wittgenstein. You spell it like Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the clarification method. He says that philosophical puzzles are solved by the clarification of language. What he needs to realize is though clarification is only one side of the coin. What about truth? What about truth? Once you clarify what somebody means, is their statement true or is it false? Now from all this, what can we say? In conclusion, there's more than one method to discover truth. No philosophical methodology can eliminate, and also, important for the Christian, no philosophical methodology can eliminate the possibility of divine revelation. We can find truth. If there is a God, he can reveal himself to us and give us truth that we could not find through other philosophical methods. But there's more than one method to discover truth. Deduction is great when you start with the universal axioms of geometry. It's great for geometry. It doesn't work with biology. Induction works better in some areas. You use induction when you drink a soda from Burger King and you assume that they're not going to poison you. They never poisoned you before, they're probably not going to poison you now. You don't deduce that. You assume it to be true through induction. You argue inductively. That's chapter 3. So the next lecture we'll pick it up with the tools of philosophy in chapter 4. We're a little behind, but not much behind.
Say it.